Let me encourage you to turn to the book of Daniel. Last Sunday morning in our sermon, we discussed Daniel as a person, and I told you then we would, since Carl was going to be out of class, rather than continue his discussions in the book of Acts, that we would spend a little more time with Daniel. And on the sheet, I've given you a little bit of an outline of the book. This is an interesting book. It's interesting because it has been used in modern times by many people as a sort of a support for their theology of the book of Revelation. And we'll get to that in just a minute. But the first six chapters of the book of Daniel are historical. And I really shouldn't be teaching this class. Richard should be teaching this class because he knows so much more about all this than I do. But just to give an ignorant person summary, Daniel is carried away into Babylonian captivity. And the first six chapters talk about that captivity. Why is Babylon so important in biblical understandings? What was Babylon about? What's the significance of Babylon? Okay, in comparison to Jesus' time, in Jesus' time, the country that was in political control was who? Rome. And the Romans had pretty much complete control over everything and everybody, and a lot of our understandings in the New Testament have to do with understanding Roman law and the customs of the Romans. You remember that Paul, who had Roman citizenship, used that quite a bit in times when he was in danger, and he had a lot of exchanges with Roman rulers, and of course it was the Romans that facilitated the crucifixion of Christ. Well, Babylon was sort of the Rome of the ancient world. They were in control, and it's kind of interesting. People talk about archaeological support. One of the neat things about Babylon is that we have incredible archaeological evidence of what went on during the time of the Babylonian rule on the earth, including Nebuchadnezzar, who is the major feature in the book of Daniel. And it's kind of interesting that Babylon is portrayed in so many ways, and Daniel is sort of a pivot book in connection with that. Daniel is carried away into Babylon captivity. He, with some of his friends, are selected to be ministers in the Babylonian hierarchy, and we talked about that last time. There's all these exchanges that go on with the time of Daniel. When he is captured, Nebuchadnezzar is in rule, but he is followed by Belshazzar, and he is followed by Darius, who was a Mede, and he is followed by Cyrus, who was a Persian. These are all Gentile kings, and they're all kings under which Daniel served. Now, Richard, you want to add anything to that? You're much more knowledgeable about this than I am. You know, you could spend literally 6 months just talking about the history of the Babylonian captivity. And there are the famous gardens of Babylon, which are mentioned in a lot of world literature. Nebuchadnezzar is mentioned. And we're going to see something. I hope we have time to get to this. But we're going to see something that happens to Nebuchadnezzar that is also recorded in secular history. But that's the first six chapters. Now, if you start with chapter 7, and let's turn to chapter 7 for a minute. If you're going to turn to chapter 7, the picture changes radically. As a matter of fact, probably the simplest way to get you to see how radical a change this is to just read the first seven verses of Daniel 7. I'm going to be reading from the NIV. You may find some minor variations if you have a different translation. Again, this is Daniel 7, beginning with verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream, and visions passed through his mind as he was lying on his bed. He wrote down the substance of his dream. Daniel said, "In my vision at night I looked, and there before me were four winds of heaven churning up a great sea. Four great beasts, each different from the others, came up out of the sea. The first was like a lion, and it had wings of an eagle. I watched until its wings were torn off, and it was lifted from the ground so that it stood on 2 feet like a man, and the heart of a man was given to it. And there before me was a second beast, which looked like a bear. It raised up on one of its sides, and it had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth. And it was told, "Get up and eat your fill of flesh." And after that I looked, and there before me was another beast, one that looked like a leopard. And on the back of it had 4 wings like those of a bird. This beast had 4 heads, and it was given authority to rule. And after that in my vision at night I looked, and there before me was a 4th beast, terrifying and frightening and very powerful. It had large iron teeth. It crushed and devoured its victims and trampled underfoot whatever was left. It was different than all the former beasts, and it had 10 horns. That sound familiar to any of you that have been in my classes before? Where have we seen something that sounded like that? The book of Revelation. And this is a section of this book which is apocalyptic. What does that mean? Anybody remember what we mean by apocalyptic literature? Written by? Written in signs, written in symbols, written where an interpretation could be made by some people who were familiar with the situation, but not to the common people. In Revelation, it was the Romans that John was dancing around. In this case, the prophecies and the fulfillment of the prophecies, much of which we can already see in history, were not made not that clear to Nebuchadnezzar. And, of course, that's where Daniel came into the picture, was in giving the interpretation to the kings of the time. So it's very, very similar, but it culminates with the establishment of the church. And to see that, let's just go over to Daniel 12 for a minute. This is sort of like reading a novel backwards, you know. You start with who the villain is, and then you go back and read the rest of the novel. But in the 12th chapter, we begin to see where all of this is played out. And starting with verse 1, "At that time, Michael, the great prince who protects your people, will arise, and there will be time of distress, which has not happened from the beginning of nations until then. But at that time, your people, everyone whose name is found written in the book, will be delivered." Now, that should sound very familiar to you. Do you remember we talked about the book and names written in the book when we were studying in the book of Revelation? Going on with verse 2, "Multitudes who sleep in the dust of the earth will be awake, some to everlasting life, others to shame and everlasting contempt." Isn't that interesting? In our discussion in my class and in Richard's discussion in his class, one of the things we have pointed out to you is that the concept of heaven and hell was predominantly a New Testament phenomenon, that you don't see in the Old Testament a lot of motivation given to people to serve God in terms of eternal existence in heaven and eternal existence in hell. But this is certainly different, isn't it? Because here you have a clear picture that talks about what happens after life. And the rest of the Old Testament doesn't do much of that, but Daniel is of interest to people because it does. And it goes on and starts building on that, picking up now with verse 3. "Those who are wise will shine like the brightness of the heavens, and those who lead many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. But you, Daniel, close up and seal the words of the scroll until the time of the end. Many will go here and there to increase knowledge. Then I, Daniel, looked up, and before me stood 2 others. You remember in our discussion recently, we had a discussion about the transfiguration and Moses and Elijah and God's statement to Christ, or to the disciples about Christ. So here we're back to that 2 witnesses again. "One of them said to me, to the man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the river, 'How long will it be before these astonishing things are fulfilled?' The man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the river lifted his right hand and his left hand towards heaven, and I heard him swear by him who lives forever, saying, 'It will be for a time and times and half a time.' You've heard that one before, haven't you? Okay, again, we saw that language in the book of Revelation. When the power of the holy people has been finally broken, all these things will be completed. And I heard, but I did not understand. So I asked, my Lord, what will the outcome of all this be? And this is kind of interesting. Starting with verse 9, he said, he replied, go your way, Daniel, because the words are closed up and sealed until the time of the end. Many will be purified, made spotless and refined, but the wicked will continue to be wicked. None of the wicked will understand, but those who are wise will understand. From the time that the daily sacrifice is abolished and the abomination that causes the desolation is set up, there will be 1,290 days. And that's time and time and half a time again, if you figure that out. Blessed is the one who waits for and reaches the end of the 1,365 days. As for you, go your way until the end. You will rest, and then at the end of the days, you will rise to receive your allotted inheritance. So, the end times are prophesied in this particular passage, and that's from 7 through 12. You know, so we sort of went back and read the end of this. The problem in the religious world has been that people have tried to relate all this to political things. And they've tried to suggest that material that I read to you a minute ago from the first seven verses of chapter 7, they've tried to interpret that in terms of Russia, in terms of China, in terms of the Arab world. And, of course, this is a part of dispensationalism. The problem is that they are not understanding the spiritual nature of the message that is involved. And that's really what we want to focus on in our discussions here. So it's kind of an interesting circumstance. The picture of the book of Daniel is important because of the way it's been misused in our day and time. And I think it's kind of important for us to look at some of the spiritual aspects of this book before we... sometime we might want to just go through the book verse by verse and tie that all together. I have a little note in here about the dispensationalist view of this, and we won't take time to go back over that. We've talked about it before. But I think it is interesting to notice the connections, and that's just a real quick summary of the book. So let's go back to chapter 2 for our study this morning. And this is kind of an interesting story. And it has, I think, some interesting applications for our world today and for the things that are going on in religion today. Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. And chapter 2 tells us about this. Let's read the first part, and then I have a couple of questions for you. Again, I'm in Daniel chapter 2, starting with verse 1. In the second year of his reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. His mind was troubled, and he could not sleep. So the king summoned the magicians, enchanters, sorcerers, and astrologers to tell him what he had dreamed. And when they came in and stood before the king, he said to them, I have had a dream that troubles me, and I want to know what it means. Then the astrologers answered the king in Aramaic, O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will interpret it. Notice what they want. Tell me the dream, and we'll interpret it. The king replied to the astrologers, this is what I have firmly decided. If you do not tell me what my dream was and interpret it, I will have you cut into pieces and your houses turned into piles of rubble. But if you tell me the dream and explain it, you will receive from me gifts and rewards and great honor. So tell me the dream and interpret it for me. Once more they replied, let the king tell his servants the dream, and we'll interpret it. The king answered, I am certain you are trying to gain time, because you realize that this is what I have firmly decided. If you do not tell me the dream, there is just one penalty for you. You have conspired to tell me misleading and wicked things, hoping the situation will change. So then tell me the dream, and I will know that you can interpret it for me. The astrologers answered the king, there is not a man on earth who can do what the king asks. No king, however great and mighty, has ever asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or sorcerer or astrologer. What the king asks is too difficult. No one can reveal it to the king except the gods, and they do not live among men. What's different about this king's handling of this situation and what happens today with people who interpret dreams, astrologers, fortune tellers, paranormal people? What's the difference? Yeah, you're not telling them the dream. Now, you tell me your dream, and I'll tell you an interpretation. I can do that right now. Tell me a dream. I'll tell you interpretation. I've got a good imagination. And I may even say a few things that will come true. Do we have anything that happens today that's like that? Patty, what are you nodding your head yes for? What's the horoscope? What is a horoscope? Well, you took my conclusion. Save that for just a second. Let me go back to my question. What's a horoscope? Okay, it's looking at the stars and planets, and particularly looking at where the sun is in the astrological signs, and predicting what's going to happen on that basis. Now, the first point I want to make here, and this is my science sneaking in on you again, but the first problem is, when was the horoscope set up? It was set up by the Chinese. How far back? About 5,000 years ago. Have the position of the stars and planets changed in 5,000 years? And the answer is, yeah. Yeah. And for instance, my astrological sign is Pisces. Okay? Well, when the thing was set up, Pisces was the month of February. But the problem is that the system has moved because the Earth and the Sun, the solar system, has moved in its position relative to the other stars. So if you look up the dates for Pisces now, it's not February. It's February 16 to March 21st. Why has that had to be moved? Because the sky is changing. So the first point that needs to be made is the whole thing is bogus. The astrological signs are not today where they were when they were set up. The second point is that when you read the astrological predictions, Richard, what are they like? Say it again. Yeah. Sweeping generalizations. You will have a good day this month. Yeah, hopefully. Hopefully. Or you will have sickness this month. What are the odds of that? You know, and sickness can mean almost anything, can't it? Okay? So they're sweeping generalizations. And this is what these guys have been doing. Notice one of the things that this thing describes, and then I'll get to your questions or comments. One of the things this describes is who was listening and who the king was talking to. Because if you look at the list of people that are coming in here, going back to chapter 2 and verse 2. So the seeing summon, the magicians, the enchanters, the sorcerers, and the astrologers. There's four different groups involved here. Four different groups. What's the difference between an enchanter, an astrologer, a magician, and a sorcerer? Anybody got an idea what the difference is? Well, yeah, although they use different things. Yeah, he's covering all his bases. Good. The astrologers are the ones we've talked about so far. They use the planets and so forth and so on. But the enchanters? What's an enchanter? Enchanters do seances. What's a seance? Okay. Yeah, depending upon what you mean by La La Land. I know some people that have been in La La Land all their life. But anyway, the point is, they stay there most of the time. But they are people that go to a different world. And the world of the dead is who usually is involved. And seances is our modern equivalent of that. What's the difference between that and a sorcerer? Okay, the Harry Potter fanatic here. They cast spells. What are spells? What's a spell? No. They use potions. What else? What went on in Harry Potter? Come on, you guys that watch Harry Potter. How did the magicians transpose this stuff? How did Harry Potter pick up his powers? A wand. Okay, so they are people that have some kind of a device. It may be a chemical device. It may be, you know, some kind of a supernatural stick or something of that type, you know. The only one that I ever enjoyed was Mickey Mouse's The Enchanter with the Walking Broomsticks. But anyway, now, what's a magician? Sleight of hand. So there's four different groups that are involved here, and the king says, you guys either put this together or you're going to be killed. I mean, he isn't messing around with these individuals. It's an ironclad test. And verses 7 and 8 indicate this guy had only been in power 2 years, but what he had already learned in 2 years, according to verses 7 and 8. Especially verse 8. You have conspired to tell me. That's verse 9. I'm sorry. Didn't go far enough. Verse 9. What have they already done? You have conspired to tell me misleading and wicked things. What's the King James say, Bill? Verse 9. Okay, so he already knew these guys were a scam artist. And, you just sort of get the feeling maybe he's weeding out the riffraff here. But Nebuchadnezzar is nobody's fool. And it's kind of interesting. You wonder what would happen in today's world. When somebody's going to, you have all these people that are supposed to be doing strange things, like the gal that's supposed to solve all the police incidents. If you had said this to one of them, somewhere in the United States, we had somebody killed today who wasn't, and where's the body? What would their response be? No, even before that. Yeah, give me time, we'll be in there, but what else? The gal that tells the police where the body is and who did it. If they just said they call her from somewhere, Washington, D.C., and they said, we had somebody killed today in the United States. Tell us who it was, where it is, and who did it. Well, yeah, she's not going to answer that. She's got to know more information. Same thing here. Exactly same thing here. So with dream interpretation, with the kind of thing that the horoscopes do, with just about all this stuff, it's easy to run a scam. And Nebuchadnezzar knows that. So it's interesting to see what's involved here. And I want to make sure, well, we got time. I want to make sure we see how Daniel handles this. Cindy? Okay, let's look now at how Daniel handles this, because it's kind of interesting what Daniel says about this. So what happens is that the king, well, verse 12, we're still in Daniel 2. This made the king so angry and furious, he ordered the execution of all the wise men of Babylon. So the decree was issued to put the wise men to death. Nebuchadnezzar is not messing around. And he's going to wipe out all of this scam stuff that is taking place. And they start looking for Daniel at this point, because somebody remembered that Daniel might have an answer to this. And it's kind of interesting the way this is worded. When Arioch, the commander of the king's guard, had gone out to put to death the wise men of Israel, or of Babylon, Daniel spoke to him with wisdom and tact. So he's handling this guy. And he asked the king's officer, why did the king issue such a harsh decree? And Arioch then explained the matter to Daniel. At this, Daniel went in to the king and asked for time so that he might interpret the dream. And Notice what Daniel does, verse 17. So Daniel returned to his house and explained the matter to his friends. And this is the guys he's been with, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He urged them to plead for mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that he and his friends might not be executed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. During the night, the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision. And then Daniel praises God. And it's interesting to read through Daniel's song here. And it is a song in which he praises God. And then in verse 24, Daniel goes to the king. And the king, verse 26, the king asked Daniel, "Are you able to tell me what I saw in my dream and interpret it?" And look at Daniel's response in verse 27. Daniel replied, "No, wise man, enchanter, magician, or diviner can explain to the king the mystery he has asked about. But there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. He has shown King Nebuchadnezzar what will happen in days to come. Your dream and the visions that pass through your mind as you lay in the bed on your bed are these." So there's a major indication here about the nature of Daniel. What does Daniel do that's remarkable in this situation? He does not take credit. Is that the way most magicians work? Most astrologers, most enchanters, etc. And that has to impress the king right off the bat, because this is different. And it also indicates something about the paranormal. And this is, I think, important. No wise man, enchanter, magician, or diviner can explain to the king the mystery he has asked about. What does Daniel say, and what does God tell us, and why does God tell us this about the whole subject of paranormal? I'm sorry? It doesn't work. It doesn't work. But it's a huge industry. How much money is spent in the United States now on a yearly basis on paranormal activities? It's over $3 billion. And you know, I get into this all the time because people are constantly throwing up, "Oh, you know what happened to so-and-so?" And it was kind of interesting. Cindy and I, right before I had that little bout with a gallbladder last year, 2 years ago, we're on the Queen Mary, and they've now run a couple of TV specials on the Queen Mary. It's enchanted. It's possessed. It's haunted. And it's a multi-million dollar business. And what's interesting to me is, what is the most successful Halloween enterprise in this area? The Haunted House in Niles. Why does that work? It's fun. And one of the things that's interesting to me about it is that they make no pretense at this thing being real. But a bunch of the people that attend do. And every year you watch, you know, it opened up this week, watch in the paper, and you're going to see people who will say, "Yeah, you know what happened to my uncle? He went through..." You know, there'll be people that are cooking up stories left and right. Why does that happen? What is it that attracts people to the paranormal? Why does that attract people? Yeah, I think that's being really charitable to say that people want the knowledge. And I'm sure there's an occasional case of that. But I don't think that's the major thing. What's the major thing, Richard? Well, let's see if you remember something I've talked to you about before. But Lawrence Krauss has written a book called Something from Nothing, in which he has proven that he now can explain how we can get something from nothing. You remember what I talked about on that? It's a bestseller. Why do people grab onto that? But what is it? How does he do that? How do you claim if something came from nothing? You change the definition. That's my wife, so she's heard me rant about this before. But you change the definition of what nothing is. And they're defining nothing as the absence of any kind of physical quantity, any kind of physical matter. So he talks about the fact that if you put matter together with antimatter, they destroy each other and you get nothing. That's not true. You get energy. You don't get nothing, you get energy. And we know that energy can be turned into matter, E equals MC squared. So what they've done is they've changed the definition to fit their religion. Why do people do that? Why do atheists, how do atheists hand over to your statement? Atheists will say, not me. I don't have that problem. I don't have to have something I can't unexplain. I may not know it yet, but eventually I will. This is called naturalism, that everything can be explained ultimately. Why do people do that? They don't want to accept the fact that there might be a circumstance where they're not in control. And my favorite illustration of this is the 12-step programs. You know, the 12-step programs, one of the fundamental precepts of the 12-step programs is to learn to look to a higher power. And the problem that I see happening to AA, which my brother is very actively involved in right now, is that they're trying to get away from Christianity, but when you try to take God and Christ out of the picture, then what is the higher power? And my brother is going through the thing where he says, well, it's nature. That's why I get out in the middle of the lake in the boat. You know, where's your higher power? Well, it's higher than me. That's because you don't swim so good. That's not a higher power. That isn't going to help you change your life. And the AA groups that have tried to work in humanist organizations have failed miserably. So, I think Richard's absolutely correct. I think it's important to understand that man has a basic need to learn to look to a higher power. And if you take God out of the picture, and I think the reason God has been taken out of the picture and the reason that Christ has been taken out of the picture is because those who claim to be God's representatives on the earth have lived so inconsistently that they don't want anything to do with it. So it's the hypocrisy. And I'm going to talk about this in my sermon today, but 40% of all Americans, when asked what their religious affiliation is, say none. 40%. That's an incredible statistic. And it's up from 8% 10 years ago. I mean, the gross rate of unbelief. And, you know, there's all kinds of contributors here. The Catholic pedophile problem, the difficulty that's been involved in some of the corruption in denominational groups, the problem with gay marriage and all the things associated with that. There's just a myriad of things. Women's rights have become an issue. All of these things put together have caused people to say, well, there can't be anything to this religion business, but there's nothing to replace it. So, you know, our general subject here is Daniel's handling of his capacity to tell the king the message. And what Daniel says is, no wise man, enchanter, magician, or diviner can explain to the king the mystery he is asked about, but there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. And this can be mental as well as physical. Before we run out of time here, I want to show you something that's absolutely astounding. Let's go over to the fourth chapter for a minute. And this, see what happens to Nebuchadnezzar. We're going to drop down to verse 33. Daniel makes a prophecy. Well, we can actually read the prophecy in verse 31. Again, this is Daniel, the fourth chapter. And the words were still on his lips when a voice came from heaven. This is what they decreed for you, King Nebuchadnezzar. Your royal authority has been taken from you. You will be driven away from people and will live with the wild animals. You will eat grass like cattle. Seven times will pass by for you until you acknowledge that the Most High is sovereign over the kingdoms of the men and gives them to anyone he wishes. Immediately what had been said about Nebuchadnezzar was fulfilled. He was driven away from the people and ate grass like cattle. His body was drenched with the dew of heaven until his hair grew like the feathers of an eagle, and his nails were like the claws of a bird. And at the end of that time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes towards heaven, and my sanity was restored. So that kind of change can happen. Is this recorded in secular history? And the answer is yes. Nebuchadnezzar, it is said, became a madman. And this is historical now. This is not biblical. But the Bible tells us this was going to happen and did happen. He goes on after he makes that statement in verse 36. At the same time that my sanity was restored, my honor and splendor returned to me for the glory of my kingdom. My advisors and nobles sought me out, and I was restored to my throne and became even greater than before. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and exalt and glorify the King of heaven, because everything he does is right and all his ways are just. And those who walk in pride, he is able to humble. You know, an amazing story. To what extent is mental illness a problem in our culture? Well, it's a huge problem, isn't it? Well, this one is. I'm not saying that with people today that's the case, but it certainly was in the case of Nebuchadnezzar. I haven't seen too many people out eating grass. And since the hippies, we were bad, but we weren't that bad. So, all righty. Well, thank you for your participation this morning. I hope that gives you a little bit of an eyeball for the book of Daniel. And sometime we may come back and look at that in more detail.